With the beginning of Sefer Shemos, we formally move into the story of Bnei Yisrael, of the Jewish people. And as many Mefarshim point out, each in their own way, the beginning of Shemos, which is really a description of the Jewish people in Galus, it's not just history in the sense that Galus is something which used to be in the way that it was. I mean, we're not in Mitzrayim anymore, but still in Galus. And Mitzrayim, in a sense, is the root, one could say, the root Galus experience for the Jewish people. Where there can be a Masa Avos for Galus. As the Chidah points out, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael Haba'im Mitzrayim, who are coming to Mitzrayim. The word Ba'im has four letters, Beis, Aleph, Yud, and Mem. Rosh HaTevos, Bavel, Edom, Yavon, and Modai. When the Jewish people come to Mitzrayim, they are pre-experiencing things that they will later on experience as a nation. No one nation has a monopoly on Golus. And there's a very chilling, I would say, comment of the Chizkuni on the word Haba'im. Because if we're describing, once again, if we're describing the past, so the Pasuk could have said, Ve'ele Shemos B'nei Yisrael Asher Ba'u Mitzrayim. How many times did they come to Mitzrayim? Just the once? Haba'im Mitzrayim is a present. And the Chizkuni comments, Mitoch Achzorius, through the cruelty, Shayu Mitzrayim Osim Lahem, that the Egyptians perpetrated on the Jewish people, Achar Misas Yosef. After the death of Yosef, that means that the Jewish people had been in Mitzrayim already for many years, for decades. And they looked around, and their neighbors are turning on them. Hayunirim lehem b'chol yom, ki ilu heim bo'im achshav. They got the impression, or they began to feel, like they just now arrived. Velo ra'u osa me'olam, and they'd never seen them before. In other words, these were people, if you ask, when did you come to Mitzrayim? When were you naturalized? We've been here for one or two or three generations, perhaps. But none of that counted for anything. When the time came, and they were looked around by people that they shared, or they thought they'd shared a common past, at least a recent history, and it's like they just arrived today, they don't know them from yesterday, and they have all the suspicion of people that just came now. They're coming right now. That's the Chizkuni on Haba'im Mitzrayim. And that's, again, unfortunately, it's not something that we celebrate or delight in, but certainly something that needs to be recognized because it would happen again. And moreover, if we look at Paro's Council of War, which is described in Pasuk Ches to Yud, Vayakam Melech Chodesh al Mitzrayim. There's a new king in Mitzrayim, Eshelo Yada, Es Yosef. Once again, he never heard from Yosef, which takes some doing. I mean, Yosef saved the country. He's never heard of him. He doesn't know who you're talking about. Vayomer Elamo, and he says, Hinei Am B'nei Yisrael, Rav Va'atzum Mimenu, the Jewish people, seemingly, what he's saying is, they are more numerous and more mighty or stronger than we are. That's quite a thing to say. More numerous than we are. It is true that many people think that there's many more Jews than there actually are. It's very easy for people to believe that. They're convinced that every third person is Jewish, seemingly. I mean, they're in the news so much. And Paro says this, Rabbat Sumimet, there's more of them than us. Even so, one could look around, it's not Ad Kedei Kach. But the Ksava Kabbalah says that Rav is not necessarily an adjective, numerous. It's a verb, Rav. They're multiplying more than we are. Which means at the moment, there may be more of us than them. But given time, seeing as they are increasing more than we are, Rav Atzumi Menu, they are gaining numbers and strength at a greater rate than we are. That's what the Ksav Kabbalah explains. It's a verb. Misrabim Yosef Mimenu. So what's the plan? The plan is in Pasuk Yud. Or more correctly, what's the fear? Hovan is Chakmalo. We need to deal wisely with them. Pen Yirbe, for they may increase, that is to say, increase more. Vayaki Sikrenum el Chamav and Osaf Gamosoneinu. If there'll be a war, they will ally themselves with our enemies. That's a matter of certainty as far as power is concerned. Based on what? We don't know. Venil Chambanu. And they will wage war against us. Ve'ala min ha'aretz. Ve'ala min ha'aretz means, and they will leave. Now, as we can appreciate, this pasuk is not so easy to understand. Because Paro is saying, the Jewish people, they're a danger, they could become our enemies, they'll align themselves with our enemies, and if that happens, and there's a war, maybe they'll leave. Well, you know, if they're that bad, that's not such a bad thing. You should want them to leave if they're really so dangerous. So it's very interesting that these final three words, Ve'olam and Ha'aretz, they represent almost like the sum of Paro's fears. The Jewish people, they're the worst thing that ever happened to Egypt, and it could even reach a stage where they may leave the country. Well, that's good. And Rashi deals with this. He quotes one Pirush al Derech HaPshat, al Korchenu, against our will they'll leave, which again, no one's stopping them. But then says Rashi, V'rabosenu darshu. But the drash is that when Paro says, and they will leave the land, he meant, and we will leave the land, meaning they'll throw us out. Why are you talking about them? Because if sometimes a person, what he's talking about is so terrible, he can't even bring himself to verbalize it. And therefore, when he expresses it, he puts the subject on other people. It's as if it says, that we will need to leave, and then they'll completely take over the land, they'll dispossess us. Which means, according to Rashi, and recognizing the problem, for them to leave is not a bad outcome. It's a good outcome. And therefore, why are you presenting this as the worst case scenario? Because, says Rashi, Paro isn't talking about them leaving. He's talking about us leaving. They'll throw us out. He can't bring himself to say us, so he says them. But he means the Egyptians. But there is a fascinating comment of the Sforno. And again, it resonates. And would reverberate again, as we anyone with the knowledge of history will know. According to the Sforno, Paro's plan for the Jewish people underwent a change. It was not the same plan from the very beginning, and we will see how that works. You see, Paro says, Hovan is Hakmelo, let's deal wisely with them, and we understand that that took the form of enslaving them. But the truth is, says the Sforno, Hovan is Hakmelo, let us deal wisely with them, is connected to the words, Ve'ala min ha'aretz. In other words, if you look closely at the Pasuk Yud, what we are witnessing is essentially the way the Torah will sometimes use brackets. And you can see it through the Tameh HaMikra without getting too involved in the different cantillation notes. The point is that Hava Nischak Malo, let us deal wisely with them, from the words Pen Yirbeh until Venil Chambanu, is what's known as a Mamar HaMuskar. It is a parenthetical statement. Let us deal wisely with them. Parenthetically, the reason why is because they are multiplying and they may ally themselves with our enemies and do war against us. End parentheses. That's why we need to deal wisely with them. But what does it mean to deal wisely with them? What are we looking to? What's the goal? The goal is Ve'ala min ha'aretz, that they should leave. Paro is saying, let's be wise with them, be smart with them, so that they will leave of their own accord. It's not a simple matter for one nation to just simply expel another one. Is there any way that we can go about this in a smart way so that they will leave by themselves? That's the goal. So it is as if we would do, we could almost, in our terminology, cut and paste the parentheses to the end of the sentence. Paro is saying, Hava nischak malo ve'olam in ha'aretz. Let's deal wisely with them so that they will leave. And then explains why all of this is necessary, pen yirbeh, etc. and so forth, v'nilcham banu. Which means plan A was for the Jewish people to leave, but it has to be done in a clever way, in a politically adept way. And that is why the very next thing we find in Pasuk Yud Aleph is not yet enslavement. Enslavement is when you're trapped. They don't want to trap the Jewish people. They want Egypt to be pure of Jewish people. How are you going to get them to leave? The answer is in the very next pasuk. Vayasimu alav sarei misim. They put tax masters. Sarei misim is not to be translated as taskmasters. Everyone knows what misim are. It's a word which needs no interpretation. Misim is tax. Leman anosa besiblosam, in order to oppress them with their burdens. With what burden? With the burden of excessive and discriminate taxation. And look how well they did. Vayivin arimar miskanos lefaris pisam es Ramses. That means that the building of these two cities, Pisam and Ramses, which we spoke about a week or two ago, Ramses is this new place, not to be confused with Ramses, where they settled. And what that means is the Egyptians were convinced that if you only lean on them financially, they'll get the message and leave Egypt. To everyone's surprise, they didn't leave. They took it. They absorbed it. They bore it. And the feeling is, and it's hard to put it to words, but life is difficult, but that's the price you pay for being Jewish in Egypt. And as long as we're okay here, either things will blow over or we'll get used to it or whatever it would be. The last thing that Egypt was expecting was for the Jewish people to pay these taxes. They hoped it would drive them out, but they stayed and paid. And when that happened, and you get two cities out of them, and they're not going anywhere, all of a sudden, Paro got to thinking, well, what else can we get from the Jewish people? Because apparently they don't move so quickly. They're not so quick to leave. But if they'll stay, maybe there's other things we can get from them. And ultimately, what began with a plan to encourage them to leave ended up with a plan where they could not leave. Because they themselves were enslaved. And that is a very, for reasons that are obvious, a very important interpretation of the Sforno, Maisa Ovos, Simon Labonim. So these are some comments with regards to, and there's much more to talk about in the opening sections, but let us move now to the Mare Hasneh, which is in Perik Gimel, the burning bush, and there's one or two things that we would like to say there. Perik Gimel, Pasuk Hei, Moshe is in Midian. He arrives at the place of Chorev. He sees the burning bush. It's burning, it's not consumed. Hashem calls to him. Pasuk Hei, Vayomer Al Tikrav Halom. And Hashem says, do not come any further. Shal Na'alecha Me'araglecha. Remove your shoes from your feet. Ki Amokam Asheta Omed Alav Admas Kodeshu. For the place where you're standing, it is holy ground. It is hallowed ground. As we know, this translates into halacha ledoros, that is to say, or halacha for the future, in the sense that ground that is holy to that degree, one is not allowed to approach or to tread on it with shoes. if halachically that becomes the Beis HaMikdash. So there are certain places where this becomes the halacha. Shal na lecha me'areg lecha. In our more immediate experience, there are also times, places in the year, where we say shal na alecha for very different reasons. On Yom Kippur, we don't wear shoes. Isur ni'ila sasandal. On Tisha B'Av, lo aleinu, a state of avelus, person doesn't wear shoes. It's very interesting to see, is there any unifying idea behind the place of the Beis HaMikdash, the time of Yom Kippur, the time of Tisha B'Av, and related times. And in fact, there is a fascinating idea which is developed based on a comment of the Vilna Gaon. The Gemara, in the end of Maseches Brachos, describes the Seder of the morning Brachos. And it's very interesting because for us, we have them all in a list, we have them in a Seder, and we say them in Shul, or we say them wherever, but we say them essentially one after the other, which is its own danger because each bracha, of course, deserves its moment. But the way the Gemara describes it is that actually each of these brachas accompanies the act that a person experiences about which the bracha relates, which means when a person opens his eyes, he says, Pokeach Ivrim. And when he stands up, he says, Okif Kefufim, and so on and so forth. It's very, very different than the way that we have it. Now, some of the brachas are more or less self-explanatory, as we said. You open your eyes, you stand up straight, you put your feet on the ground. Rokah ha'aretz alamayim. And one of the brachas, however, be very interesting to know when a person should experience that, so he should say that bracha. And that is, she'asa li kol tzarki, you have provided all of my needs. Now, depending on who you ask, if you say, at what point in the day do you experience that Hashem has provided all of your needs to the extent that you make that bracha? So some people may answer, well, you know, I'm still waiting. I'd love to make that blessing. I've been waiting a long time, actually. But it's a bracha that you make every day. And amazingly, the Gemara says, the point that a person makes that bracha is when he puts his shoes on. Which propels the whole concept of shoes to an entirely different level. It's very interesting when the Gemara attaches these definitions to things. We might think these are abstract or concepts that are uncontainable or indefinable. And someone says, define everything. And the Gemara says, okay, shoes. And then we're not sure what to do with that. The Vilna Gaon explains. Of course, when we talk about shoes, we mean leather shoes without getting into the halachas. But what is the significance of shoes? And why is it when a person puts his shoes on, it says, she'asali kot sarfi? Because, says the Vilna Gaon, a leather shoe means that a person is entitled to take another living animal in the world and use it for his needs. If shoes come from leather, that means it comes from an animal. And what it represents is that man has been charged and entitled with using the world for his needs. And it's for this reason that when a person puts his shoes on, representing his dominion, so to speak, over everything else in the world is at his disposal. And that's called She'asani Kol Tzarki. As the Pasuk in Tehillim says, Ma'enersh kitiz kirenu, tamshilehu amasi adecha, Tehillim perek ches, you've given dominion over everything. Kol shato tachas raglav, you've placed everything under his feet. There's something about taking another living being and using it in that way, and it is literally under your feet. That's why that bracha is recited at that point. Well, as Mefarshim point out, perhaps we can understand why, if that's where the significance of wearing shoes, then maybe there are certain places and maybe there are certain times where it is not appropriate to wear shoes. The place is the Beis HaMikdash. That means the Beis HaMikdash is so suffused and permeated with an awareness of Hashem's presence in the world, that's not a time when a person then makes a point of the distinction between him and everything else in the world. It's almost like it's leveled. All of temporal experience and existence is leveled before the presence of Hashem. And therefore, a man is greater than an animal, that's true. But everything is null compared to the infinite. And that's represented by him taking his shoes off as he enters into the Beis HaMikdash. When it comes to Yom Kippur, it's a different tributary to this idea. But Yom Kippur is really a day, one could say, where a person needs to examine whether he has responsibly interacted with the world and deserved the privileged place that he has, where the world is under his feet. Yom Kippur is a day where we recognize that perhaps we have not been sufficiently on level in terms of being fully deserving of using the world. And therefore, from a certain point of view in Yom Kippur, we step down from that privileged status and we take a bit of stock. And then the moment when a person puts his shoes on Yom Kippur, he should have re-deserved the right to wear them. And indeed, the minhag of some, I believe it's the minhag of the Arizal, is that on those days where a person doesn't wear shoes, he doesn't make the bracha of she'asa li kol tzorki until he puts his shoes on Motzei Tainis. Tisha B'Av and Lo Aleinu, again, Avelus, these are things that bereavement is something which is shared by, it's part of life until Tchias HaMeisim, it's shared by every living being. And therefore, once again, it's an equalizer. And before such a state, a person takes his shoes off. The distinction between man and animal, it doesn't stand in a situation like that. So this is a very interesting perspective on what is effectively the halacha, that one doesn't wear shoes in the Beis HaMikdash. When we appreciate what wearing shoes represents, it's not appropriate when you're in that location called the Beis HaMikdash with what that represents. That's based on the Vilna Gaon. However, or in addition, I came across a fascinating comment in the Sefer Hasidim. And the truth is that the Sefer Hasidim, Rabbi Yehuda HaChosid, one of the Hasidic Ashkenaz, everything he says is fascinating. He is Bechezkas fascinating, even before he's even said anything. But here, in section 822, he says as follows. It's two lines, but to follow carefully. Tzarech Adam le'ayen, a person should be very, should inspect. Shelo yidbak bimin olav tsoa, that he should not, nothing should stick to his shoes, no dirt or filth or anything like that. Kishaholech lebeis hakneses. When a person is about to enter a shul, he should check his shoes. It's not covered for a shul that a person should enter with dirt on his shoes. And he quotes a pasuk in Koheles. It's a well-known pasuk, and it could mean many things, but this is the simplest translation. Shemor raglecha kasher telech el beis elokim. Guard your feet when you go to a house of God. Meaning, look at them and make sure that they're clean. So a person should inspect his shoes and clean them if necessary. Okay, that's good to know. Says the Sefer Hasidim, V'lochach kesiv shal na'alecha me'al raglecha. And that is why the pasuk, or thus does the pasuk say, remove your shoes from your feet. Now what the Sefer Hasidim is saying is that the instruction for Moshe to remove his shoes from his feet, which then becomes halacha ledoros in not entering the Beis HaMikdash wearing shoes, it is essentially for the reason that one should not bring the dirt on one's shoes into the Mokam HaMikdash. So how do you deal with it? You take your shoes off, leave them at the entrance, walking barefoot. Now, as we can appreciate, there has to be a little bit more to say, because here we're explaining that the reason why, time and akra almost, right, the reason why a person is not allowed to wear shoes in the Makam HaMikdash is out of respect for it, they shouldn't bring dirt in. But we know that the very same concern, at least in principle, exists with every shul, but there's no ban on wearing shoes in shul, so presumably it's enough to check your shoes and clean them if necessary. Why does it take the form of not wearing shoes at all in the Beis HaMikdash? And this question is raised by Reb Reuven Margolius Zatzal. He has a wonderful collection of notes on Sefer Hasidim called Mekor Chesed. And Reb Reuven Margolius asked this question. Here we're saying that it's the same idea, not to bring dirt into shul, perhaps on your feet, but if it's the same idea, why does it not express itself the same way practically? Before coming into shul, look at your feet. Before coming into Beis HaMikdash, remove your shoes. But it's the same concern. It is the same concern, says Reb Reuven Margolius. But as we know, it is often true that when you enter a, shall we say, a more sensitive arena, or a more sensitive area, the response to a concern becomes greater. As if to say, there is no question that the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash is much, much greater than the Kedusha of a shul. They're both Kaddish, but the Beis HaMikdash is in a completely different realm. And therefore, although the concern is the same, but the measures that you need to protect against it vary. It's a sliding scale, it's gradiated. As if to say, for a shul, the concern is there, but it can be dealt with by just looking at your shoes and making sure that there's no dirt attached to them that would be brought into shul. That's sufficient. That is a satisfactory response to that concern. When it comes to the Beis HaMikdash, the response is just on a completely different level, as if to say, we don't even tell you to inspect, we didn't tell you to clean, we didn't tell you to anything. The whole thing is vetoed, is literally left at the door. Because in keeping with the heightened sensitivity and kedusha of the Makom HaMikdash, it is an all-out response just to completely remove your shoes and come in without them. But the idea at heart is exactly the same. What's very interesting is Reb Reuven Margolius then makes reference to one or two sources, one from Chazal and then a couple in the Poskim, which might be quite surprising to us, but now we can appreciate where they come from. There is a Yerushalmi in Maseches Bav Metzia in the second parak. The second parak of Bav Metzia, as we know, is Eile Metzias. It deals with the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda, of things that get lost and things that get found and how they get returned. Hashavas Aveda. And one of the Rabbonim there in the Yerushalmi tells of the way that he lost his shoes. How did he lose his shoes? Because he says, when I went to shul, I took my shoes off, I left them outside, and when I finished davening, they were gone. So what's very interesting is, as is often the case, the reason that the Yerushalmi or the Chazal discuss this, it might be quite different than what is of particular interest to us right now. As if to say, the Yerushalmi then launches into a discussion of how could you get them back, and how do you prove that it's yours, Hashavas Aveda. But says Reb Reuven Margolius, but for us, in our present discussion, we should note that he is essentially saying that his practice was that he would not bring his shoes into shul, he would take them off at the door and walk in without them. And we can appreciate why that is based on the Sefer Hasidim, as if to say, there's room to be machmir. It's very interesting to look upon it as a chumrah. The zum to be machmir, as if to say, the Torah only demanded that a person remove his shoes before going to the Beis HaMikdash. You don't need it for shul, but you can well understand why there were certain places where people would remove their shoes before going into shul. It's only better. All of this is completely foreign to us, of course, because we have associations with anyone who takes off their shoes before they go into their place of worship. For us, that's already that has different associations. But the pure halacha doesn't need to be affected by any of that. And indeed, there were certain gedolim throughout the ages who had this practice. The Rashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Semach, who lived in Algeria in the 14th century, as is noted by his son, the minag in his shul was no one wore shoes. Everyone took mamish like the Yerushalmi in Bav Metzia. Everyone took their shoes off. It sounds quite foreign to us, but the more you appreciate where it comes from in the first place, the more you can see that there were certain places. And I'm not sure if it will make a comeback anytime soon, but always important to appreciate the background to different minhagim, and specifically their roots and their sources. So that's Rav Ibrahim Margolius on the Sefer Chasidim with regards to Tishal Na'alecha Me'al Raglecha. Now, further on, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is in dialogue with Moshe. He's going to send Moshe, and there's many psukim here. And one of the things that Moshe says, if we take a look at Pasuk Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, Vayomer Moshe El Elokim. So Moshe has been, Hashem has appeared to Moshe, he's sending him to take Bnei Yisrael from Mitzrayim. Moshe says, Hinenuchi ba'al Bnei Yisrael. So that, okay, so let's say I'll come to Bnei Yisrael. V'amarti lahem elokei avosechem shlochani alechem. And I will say, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. V'amar li mashemo. And they'll say, what's his name? Ma'omar lahem. What should I say? Vayomer Elokim Moshe. So Hashem says to Moshe, Ehye Asher Ehye. That's my name. Ehye Asher Ehye. Vayomer, and goes on to say, Kotomar Levnei Yisrael, say to Bnei Yisrael, Ehye Shlochani Aleichem. So in brief, Moshe's question is, I'm anticipating they will ask me, what's your name? What is your name? Hashem says, my name is Ehye Asher Ehye. Tell them Ehye sent you. Now, as we can appreciate, both the question and the answer need to be pondered and understood, because this is not a name that which we're familiar at all, not from before, and we never find it again. So what is the meaning of Moshe saying they'll ask me what is his name? I mean, why do they need to know his name? Do they not know his name? And why is the answer such an unusual name, or at least rare? Unique, actually, just in this moment in the Chumash. And furthermore, having already said the full name, so to speak, of Ehye Asher Ehye, why then does Hashem say, abbreviate it in terms of what you should say to Bnei Yisrael? One almost gets the feeling that this is Hashem's full name, but don't tell them the full name, just tell them the first Ehye. But what is the background to all of this? And there's many Perushim in the Rishonim. Rashi quotes the Gemara straight away. That actually, before we get to what Hashem's name is, what is the meaning of asking what his name is? The meaning is, Hashem's name, and Hashem has many names, because each name represents for Hashem the way that he interacts with those with whom he's interacting at that time, with the world generally, with the Jewish people specifically, with a certain individual. Which means that when Bnei Yisrael are saying, or will ask, what is his name, what they mean to say is, how is this working? How is Hashem interacting with us? What platform or basis will the redemption from Egypt take? And what is the answer to that question? The word Ehye, and this is Rashi from the Gemara, means I will be with them. It means I'm with you, that's why I'm taking you out. But the full name, Ehye Asher Ehye, again, Rashi from the Gemara, means, because I'll be with you on more than one occasion, and more than one occasion like this. Ehye imayim begolos. So I'll be with you in this golos to take you out. Ve'eye imayim begolos acheros. I'll be with you in subsequent golos to take you out. But then it gets abbreviated. And in the words of the Gemara, because Moshe says, famous words, Daya letzara b'shata, one thing at a time. The Jewish people need encouragement at this stage. They don't need necessarily to hear that Hashem will be with them in subsequent exiles, because you're basically telling them that there will be subsequent exiles. Let them enjoy the redemption here. And Hashem says, you're right. And moreover, as Maharal explains, Hashem never intended for Moshe to say the whole name about this golus and that golus. But if you want to know what my name is, this is how it's working. This golos and other golios. But for the Jewish people, of course, don't talk to them about other golios. Dial at Sarah Bashata, 100%. That was never meant for them. All they need to hear is Hashem will be with you. That's all you know and all you need to know. Ehye shlochani alechem. But why are subsequent golios part of how this redemption is working? That remains a good question, even if the Jewish people shouldn't hear it. But why is it relevant now? Presumably, Ehyeh is the only name that's relevant now. I'll be with you, whatever that means, but that's what it means. Apparently, somehow, Hashem being with the Jewish people in subsequent exiles is actually part of why he's taking them out now. And that's why it really is the full answer to how they're being taken out of Egypt. Somehow, subsequent exiles are also part of the Jewish people being taken out of Egypt. But we need to understand why that is. And again, there's many explanations of this matter, but there's a classic comment which is to be found in the Sefer Meir Einei Chachamim, which was written by Rav Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtsa, the Ostrovtsa Rebbe, one of the greats. My father once remarked to me that Rav Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtsa was the last of the Rebbes, the last of the Hasidic Rebbes. I didn't ask him what he meant, and I can't really ask Hasidim nowadays, but it's certainly a personality of distinction and a great gaon. He draws our attention to a well-known statement which relates to Parshas B'Shalach. As we know, on the eve of going out from Mitzrayim, everyone is involved in V'Shalu Ishmeisri Ehu, Klei Chesu V'Klei Zahav, they're getting gold, they're getting silver. Only Moshe is doing something else. He's taking Atzmos Yosef. As we know the whole story, he went to the Nile, Ale Shor, and he took the Yosef's coffin and took it with him. But he got Moshe, Atzmos Yosef, Ima. And commenting on that, the Gemara in Masechet Sota and Daf Yud Gimel quotes the pasuk in Mishle, Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvos. A person who is wise of heart takes mitzvos. And the Gemara says, look at the Jewish people. What are they doing? What are they involving themselves with the night before Yetzias Mitzrayim? Gold, silver. Look at Moshe. Moshe takes mitzvahs. Now, understandably, that's not an easy thing to say, as it almost sounds like it's in criticism of the Jewish people. How can they be so materialistic? How can they, all they have in their mind is gold and silver at a time like this? It's not so simple. They were told to take gold and silver. You can't fault them. You can't make it a mitzvah and then criticize them for fulfilling that mitzvah. It's not their fault. For once in history, it was a mitzvah for them to collect gold and silver. Very nice. I mean, we like to keep in practice ever since, just in case, you never know. But it's a mitzvah. So we say, Moshe went after mitzvah. So did they. It's not their fault that it's gold and silver. That's what they were told. But the point is, says Meir Yechiel, but it was a mitzvah. But was it a real mitzvah? And we'll explain exactly what that means. Why were they told to take gold and silver? What is that? Where is that coming from? It's in fulfillment, seemingly, of V'achareichen Yetzu B'chush Gadol. And that's the promise. When it's all over, V'achareichen Yetzu B'chush Gadol. Well, there's a well-known comment concerning Hashem's instructions at that time. Because when Hashem tells Moshe to tell them to collect gold and silver, he says, please. That's daberna ba'osneam. Please tell them. Why the please? I mean, mitzvahs don't normally have the word please in them. I mean, they're commandments. And the Gemara says, Maseches Brochas and Daftes quoted in Rashi, Ein no el aloshen bakosha. It is a request, Hashem says, I'm requesting for you. Tell them to take the gold and silver, because otherwise Avram will complain that they were persecuted and they never got the gold and silver at the end. You fulfilled the persecution and not the treasure, and therefore I don't want Avram to complain, so please do me a favor and ask him to take the gold and silver. Now that comment itself, of course, needs to be understood, because for whatever reason that Hashem said they'll leave with Berchush Gadol, that's the reason why they need to do it, not just that Avram won't complain. And if Avram wouldn't complain, you wouldn't do it? What about the fact that you said it? That's what will happen. That should be reason enough. What's it got to do with Avram? But the point is, as Meir Yechiel, no. There was no real requirement for them to take Berchush Gadol. Why? Because Rechush Gadol comes at the end. V'achareichen Yetzu Rechush Gadol. When Golos is over. When the Bris Ben HaBesorim is over. But at this stage it wasn't over. And this brings us to the classic discussion. We spoke about it last week, and then we will speak about it Mitzvah Hashem on other occasions as well. How to understand that we left Mitzrayim very shortly after, just halfway through being there for 400 years. We've discussed many approaches to this question. Maybe it began with Yitzchak, and maybe 400 years was rolled into the time that we were there. There are many approaches. But it, in a number of places, the Medrash is quite states quite simply that we left halfway through because we couldn't stay anymore. We just had to leave in the middle. It wasn't finished. Which means that in reality, there was no yet requirement of V'acharichein Yetzu B'chush Gadol, because we're not in the V'acharichein stage yet. It hadn't finished at that time. And that really takes us back to Moshe's question to Hashem. They'll say, what's his name? Meaning, how is this working? As if to say, they understand that the Golus hasn't finished. And what is the answer? The answer is, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. Why are they coming out now? Because you're right, the Golus hasn't finished. It will be continued at a later time. But for now, they need to leave. That's the full answer. And that's why subsequent exiles are part of the name here, because subsequent exiles are what allows for the interruption of this exile to happen, because it will continue later on, but for now it has to stop. Eheyeh begolus zo, asher eheyeh begolus acheres. That's the full answer, and that's how it's working. The only thing is, you cannot explain that without bringing in future exiles. And Moshe says the Jewish people can't hear about future exiles now. So Hashem says, so don't tell them about future exiles, but that's the answer. Tell them eheyeh. So what's very interesting here? The Jewish people do not realize that there will be subsequent exiles. As far as they're concerned, it's over. But that's not true. But Moshe can't tell them the truth, because they can't take it at this stage. They can't hear about future exiles. And where does it come out? That's why it's a favor to Avram that they should take the gold and silver. There is no real requirement yet. The exile isn't finished. But Avram, who's the pillar of chesed, he says the Jewish people, as far as they're concerned, it's over. So they knew when they were being persecuted, let them leave with gold and silver. But it's not an essential requirement. It's a favor to Avram. But for the Jewish people, as far as they're concerned, Golus is over. And no one knows differently except for one person, Moshe. Only Moshe knows that the Golus isn't over. Only he has heard the full name, Eheyeh Asher Eheyeh. But he was told to keep it to himself. And he did. But because of what he knows, that sets him apart than everyone else. Says Rav Meir Yechiel, that's why on the night of leaving Mitzrayim, everyone went for gold and silver, but Moshe didn't. He went for a mitzvah. Because Moshe knows that there is no real requirement to take the gold and silver. It's not the real Rechush Gadol yet. But he can't tell anyone. And therefore, with that secret, he goes off for a mitzvah. And that's why, says Rav Meir Yechiel, the pasuk quoted from Mishle is Chacham Lev Yikach Mitzvahs. A person who has wisdom in his heart will take mitzvahs. And the application on that occasion was to Moshe. He had a piece of wisdom in his heart that he couldn't share with anyone else. Namely, the Golus isn't over yet. He can't tell anyone because they can't take it. And therefore, he kept it to himself, but that means everyone else thought it's time for a Rechush Gadol. But Moshe's Chacham Lev, with the wisdom that he carries with him, he knows that's not so. If he wants a mitzvah, he's going to need a real mitzvah, so to speak, which is to take Atzmus Yosef. So that's a very interesting, as it takes its place among the many interpretations of both of the Gemara and of Rechush Gadol from the Ostrotzer Rebbe. I'd like to conclude by presenting a discussion which is found in the Drushas Metzach Aaron. Metzach Aaron are the Drushas of Rav Aaron Volkin, the Rav of Pinsk. He's the base Aaron on the Masechtas, and these are very, very special Drushas. His grandson, should have been well, Rav Chaim Volkin, was my Rebbe. And actually, the Volkins were family with the Soloveitchiks. And the introduction to one of the Sfarim, I believe even the Metzach Aaron, is written by Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, Aaron Soloveitchik. And he heard the Pinsker Rav give some of these drushas. And Rav Soloveitchik says about Rav Aaron Volkin something that I do not know if he said it about anyone else. And his words are, Mi shelo shoma es Rabbi Aaron Doresh, a person who never heard Rav Aaron Volkin give a drusha, lo shoma darshan miyomav, he's never heard a drusha in his life.
He held him to be the quintessential darshan. High praise from Rav Soloveitchik himself, spellbinding orator. And what does Rav Volkin say? It's in his drushes, although as we'll see, it's pure parshanut. He has what to say in drush, mitzvah Hashem on other occasions, but as we'll see, it is a very close analysis of the of the relevant sections here. And he begins by directing us to Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Ches. The Moshe's been told to go to the Jewish people and give them this message. Says Pasuk Yud Ches, v'shamudu kalecha, they will listen to you. Uvaso atav zikne Yisrael el melech Mitzrayim, and you and the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt. Va'amartem elav, and say, Hashem elokeihor ivriim nikra aleinu, Hashem the God of the Hebrews, he is connected with us, happened to us. Va'ato nelchana derech shlosh yomim bamidbar v'nizbecha l'Hashem elokeinu. We would like now to go for 3 days to sacrifice before Hashem. Two questions. Firstly, what exactly is the role of the Zakenim here? Moshe, when we tell the story, we don't always factor them in. Does it make a difference? I mean, Moshe and Aaron, they're the ones with the message. Well, I mean, what are the Zakenim? They're the elders of the people. But why is it important they should be there? Secondly, and a well-known question, were they only really asking for 3 days? I mean, here it is. And by the way, we're not going to hear it again. But for here, it is express, explicit, let us go for 3 days. They only ever wanted 3 days. Doesn't sound right. We know that they wanted more. The time has come. Let's move to Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Beis. And this, here we find Hashem's instructions to Moshe. What Moshe should say to Paro. Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Beis. V'amar Tal Paro, you, this is Hashem talking to Moshe, you shall say to Paro, Karmar Hashem, Bini Bechor Yisrael, Yisrael are my firstborn, V'amar Elecha, Shalach es Bini, let them go, send them out, V'yavdeini, let them serve me. Interesting. In a number of ways. Firstly, Moshe does not give a limitation at all. In fact, he uses the term shalach esami, and shalach has a connotation of releasing absolutely. When you send something out, you send it away, that means you get rid of it. That's not the same as 3 days. It's also interesting that in the earlier pasuk, which is Perek Gimel Pasuk Yud Ches, Paro is referred to as Melech Mitzrayim. You and the elders of Israel will come to Melech Mitzrayim. Who's Melech Mitzrayim? Paro. Why is he called Melech Mitzrayim? Because he's the king of Egypt. But in the second Pasuk, Perek Dalet Pasuk Kaf Gimel, Kaf Beis, V'amarta El Paro, say to Paro. Who's Paro? He's the king of Egypt. So why is it in the earlier Perek he's referred to as Melech Mitzrayim, and the later he's referred to as Paro, when the two are essentially the same thing? So what difference does it make how you refer to him? I mean, Paro is his official name. Where do we move from here to the actual message as delivered? So far we've seen two versions of the message as will be or should be delivered. Let us see the message as delivered in the beginning of Perek Hay. Perek Hay Pasuk Aleph. V'achar, after this, Ba'u Moshe Ba'aron, Ba'yom Ruel Paro, Kor Ma'ashem Elokei Yisrael, Shalach Esami V'yachogu Li Bamidbar. So when they finally come to Paro, they actually don't say exactly either of the two original formulae. Which means, on the one hand, they say Shalach, right, which is part of the second. But the second is Shalach Esami V'yavduni. Here it says Shalach Esami V'yachogu Li Bamidbar. Well, that's not exactly the same. I mean, it's approximately the same, but it's not exactly the same. Why is it they were originally told to say Shalach Esami V'yaduni, let them serve me, and now it becomes V'yachogu Li Bamidbar, and let them rejoice before me in the in the wilderness.
The kol ze omer darshenim. They were just reading the psukim, but there's so many psukim, and it's very easy not to notice the differences between them, but then we don't do justice to the psukim.
The truth is, says the Metzach Aaron, Paro needs to hear two messages,
two different messages, for two different reasons. On the one hand, he needs to hear the facts, as if to say he needs to hear the full demand from the beginning. There shouldn't be a notion of changing your mind. That means he needs to hear from someone that the demand is to let them go completely. And that's Moshe's job. And that's Shalach. And that's Shalach Asimivi Avduni. Let them go, they're going to be serving me, and not you. And it's finished. Send them out.
But he also needs to hear another message, because it's important for people at the time and beyond that time to understand just the depths of the evil of Paro. And it would not come out if he was only told, let them go permanently. Because most people would not be prepared to let an entire nation that is serving them just go free. It's called being selfish, and most people are selfish. Which means, although it's wrong for him to enslave them, but if you say that he was told, let release them permanently, and he said no, he doesn't want them to go permanently. You don't see the full depth of the evil of Paro, but you do when he also receives a request, is it okay if we just go for 3 days? 3 days for 210 years is not bad. I mean, that's savir, as they say. That's reasonable. And because it's reasonable, the full depth of how unreasonable Paro was only comes out when he won't even let them go for 3 days. And therefore, it's of the essence that Paro be presented with these two requests. Or more correctly, one's a request and one's a demand. And that's why when the Zakenim, and who is it that should offer these, that he should hear this from? He's never enslaved Moshe and Aaron. They're not coming to him, in a sense, with a request. They're coming, they're outside the picture. They're ex machina in the sense that they're not enslaved that are looking for some type of respite. They are coming from the outside, demanding the release of the people. But the Zakenim, this is where the Zakenim come in. Because the Zakenim, they represent the people that are suffering. And they then come with a request. That's the first thing Paro needs to hear. Nelchana, is it okay if we just go? We're not asking you to release us. We're just asking that we can go, and it's only for 3 days. That's the request of the elders. And because they have a very different relationship between them and Paro, as opposed to Moshe and Paro, and what is the difference? They are subject to Paro against their will, but they're subject to Paro. Moshe's not subject to Paro. And that's why within the context of the Zakenim's request, as the people being subject to him, he is referred to as Melech Mitzrayim. His monarchy is more pronounced, because as king, he's not Moshe's king. Which means that in the second Pasuk, in Perek Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Beis, Moshe never talks to the king of Egypt. Moshe talks to Paro. And there's two people. Which means on the one hand, as threading through now these psukim, the Zakenim come to their king with a request for 3 days. Moshe comes to Paro with a demand for total release. And that's why in Pasuk Kaf Beis he comes to Paro, Shalach Hashem Yavduni, there's no 3 days, it's full sending out. And that's and those two, between the two messages, Paro will have heard the demand from the beginning, and he will have denied the request from the beginning. And we need both. Very interesting. So then what happened? What happened then is even of further interest. Only Moshe and Aaron actually went to Paro. As Pasuk, Perek Hei Pasuk Aleph outlines, Va'achar ba'u Moshe va'Aaron el Paro. Only Moshe and Aaron came. Why only Moshe and Aaron? Rashi says, everyone else, they just couldn't do it. It's a big thing. And they've been enslaved and oppressed for so they couldn't bring themselves to go to Paros. As Rashi says, it one by one they kind of slipped away. What began as a delegation of 72 ended up as a delegation of 2. And that's the reality. But what that means is that Paro no longer has 2 delegations to give him 2 messages. The Zakenim were meant to say one thing, Moshe's meant to say something else, but there's no Zakenim anymore. So with only 1 delegation, how are you going? Is he going to hear both messages? It has to be that Moshe now takes on both roles, and he blends the messages and see how Paro reacts. And that's why, if we look again at Moshe's Pasuk Aleph, Achar Bo Moshe Ba'aron, Vayomer Paro, they say to Paro, because this is Moshe, and he talks to Paro as an equal. Paro is not his king. And says, Ko'amar Hashem Elokei Yisrael, Shalach Esami V'yachoguli Bamidbar. You see, that's a hybrid of the 2 messages, because he needs to assume both roles. On the one hand, there's the word Shalach, which has a connotation of full-on release. But on the other hand, v'yachoguli, and there should be a festival which has a much more temporary connotation. He doesn't say 3 days, and it can mean anything. But he's given voice to both of these. There's shalach, which demands complete release, emancipation, and v'yachoguli, which also has a connotation. But maybe it's just for a little while. And Paro's heard aspects of both. And how does Paro respond? Vayomer Paro, mi Hashem asher shma b'kolo l'shalach es Yisrael. Who is Hashem? I should listen to him to release the Jewish people. Lo yadati es Hashem v'gam es Yisrael lo ashaleach. Paro had heard more in a more pronounced fashion the demand to let them go completely. He doesn't talk about a festival. He doesn't talk about anything. He says, I'm not releasing them. Meaning, I'm not releasing them for good. So that's been heard loud and clear. Ah, so of the 2 aspects within the first message, shalach and festival, Paro heard shalach. And he says, no, but he's heard shalach. So then Moshe's follow-up is to give more voice to the other part of it, which is the very next pasuk. Vayomer Elokei Ha'Ivrim, Nikra Aleinu, Ne'elchan Aderech Shloshes Yamim Bamidbar. Now you can talk about the 3. He's heard your demand, and he said no, but he's heard it, and now you ask for 3, and Paro is not interested in that as well. And that is how Moshe, in a sense, had to redesign the message in order to have elements of both, and then work with Paro's reaction to make sure that both got heard. So this is really classic parshanut on the part of Aaron Volkin. As we know, for as far as Sefer Shemos is concerned, this is just the beginning, but our discussions for this evening, for the moment, are concluded. We'll leave it open.